It's time for Security Now. Yay! Steve Gibson is here, our Turkey Day edition, and there are a few turkeys to talk about, including the Uber breach. We'll talk about a new DNS service that Steve's going to switch to right away. And, of course, our picture of the week, exactly why you have to be careful if you're an IT professional where you go to work. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 638, recorded Tuesday, November 21st, 2017, Quad 9. Security Now is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/securitynow. And by Lighthouse. Lighthouse is the only security camera powered by the same technology that's in self-driving cars. And just for TWiT fans, visit light.house/twit and get 40% off your very own Lighthouse with the Lighthouse Intelligence Service Plan. Supplies are limited, so hurry. And by IT Pro TV. A good IT pro is always learning, and IT Pro TV is the resource to keep you and your IT team's skills up to date. Visit itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. It's time for Security Now, the show where we get together with Steve Gibson, our security officer, chief CSO, chief security officer, to learn about what's going on the worldwide. What the heck is it? Hello, Steve.
Yo, Leo.
Good to see you.
Great to be with you again for our 638th episode.
Wow.
Had we begun numbering from zero, of course, 638 would be the 639th episode, but we're unable to go back and change time. So,
is that the first thing you'll do if you get a time machine?
Yeah, we really should have renumbered this. We should have. -1, that'd be a fun start, but
oh, yeah.
Especially since it was about the honey monkeys. So,
yeah.
You know, that one could have been the -1 episode, but no. So this is the week of a Windows birthday, which we're going to talk about. Not a big birthday, but it was yesterday. So I thought, oh, that's kind of fun. The RTM of Windows 1.0 happened on November 20th. That was yesterday, since it's the 21st that we're recording this. So there's that. And I heard you talking on MacBreak Weekly about net neutrality. So we'll spend much less time on the topic than you guys all did. But I just wanted to bring up this disturbing announcement that will come to pass about a little over 3 weeks from now on. I think it was December the 21st. No, I don't remember. Anyways, the 14th, I think. Anyway, that's happening. We've got Intel's response to the horrifying JTAG over USB discovery that we talked about last week. Another surprising AWS, that's Amazon Web Services, public bucket discovery. Android phones caught sending positioning data even when all permissions to do so are denied. A surprising number of websites, sort of a disturbing number, found to be watching their visitors' actions even like without submitting any information to the website. More fallout from the Infineon ID card bad public key synthesis problem. The return of Blueborn that we discussed in early September. A new arrival to our, well, that didn't take long department. We have... and unfortunately, that this is regarding the Amazon Key service that we just talked about.
Oh, yeah.
That didn't take long. We've got speedy news for Firefox 57, a bit of miscellany, some listener feedback. And then, because this episode is titled Quad 9, we're going to talk about a very appealing and very speedy privacy and security enhancing DNS service known as Quad 9, and you can guess the IP because
Quad 9,
it's in the name. Yeah. So I think an interesting podcast for all our listeners, not surprisingly, because the industry keeps giving us good things to talk about.
There's plenty of juice in this.
We're never running out.
Yep. Well, while we're give you a chance to catch your breath, not that you've done anything to use your breath yet, but while you're doing that, I maybe have a cup of Joe. Actually, I got to get a cup of Joe myself. Let's talk a little bit about our sponsor, Rocket Mortgage. I shouldn't have to explain this to you now. After all, we've been talking about them for some time. And I think a lot of people discovered Rocket Mortgage because it's a better way to get a home loan for your house or refi your house. Better for a couple of reasons. One, because it comes to you from Quicken Loans, the best lender in the country. Number one in customer satisfaction, year after year after year, according to J.D. Power, both for mortgage servicing, but also for mortgage origination, the loan approval process. And that's where they really hit one out of the park this time, with Rocket Mortgage. That's what they call it. It is a completely online mortgage approval process. You will not have to go to a bank. You will not have to meet a lender. You will not have to go through boxes of paperwork to find your pay stubs, your bank statements. You can do it all online. And thanks to the power of computing, it can happen in very little time. The last time we got a home loan, when Lisa and I bought our house, it was 4 years ago, and it was from the big bank, and it took us months. I mean, I'm not even exaggerating. We thought, it might take a few weeks. After a month, we knew we were going to be going on vacation. It still hadn't been approved. The home seller was starting to say, guys, if you don't get a loan, I'm going to sell it to somebody else. We were freaking out. We went on the cruise because we had already booked it. Had a fax. May I underscore the word facsimile stuff to the bank. Even from vacation, we were calling Lisa's sister saying, you got to go find this and that. It was crazy. Man, next time, Rocket Mortgage, you do the whole thing. You could do it on your phone at an open house. It's that easy and fast. First of all, because Quicken Loans has trusted partnerships with all the financial institutions, you don't have to go get pay stubs or bank statements or anything. You just go to Quicken Loans website, rocketmortgage.com/securitynow. You fill out the basic information. They say, is this your bank? Yep. Okay. You give us permission to look at it? Yep. They get the information they need right from the financial institutions. That's all they need. They crunch the numbers. It's computerized, so it doesn't take a month or weeks or days or even hours. It takes a minute or two. And based on income and assets and credit, Rocket Mortgage is going to analyze all the available home options, loan options, or loptions, as I call them, home loan options, and pick the one that's right for you. You choose the down payment, the term, the rate. It's completely transparent. Every step of the way, you'll know exactly what's going on. And then you'll pick a mortgage, and it'll say on your phone, approved. You could actually do it in an open house and show the realtor, look, we're approved for the loan. We'd like to make an offer. And by the way, that is a huge, huge advantage when you're buying a house to have the loan. Like I said, we almost lost the house because it took us so long to get the loan. RocketMortgage.com/securitynow. From Quicken Loans, apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. Equal housing lender, of course, licensed in all 50 states, of course, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. RocketMortgage.com/securitynow. Maybe you're not buying a house right this minute. I figure you're probably not. Although some of you might be. Bookmark it. Have it ready because the time will come. Put it on your phone. That way you can just say, I'm approved. RocketMortgage.com/securitynow. Okay, Steve, I got a picture of the week right in front of me right now.
Yes, we do. And I love it. It's someone sitting in front of the human resources guy desk, and he is speaking. And the caption says, this is the HR guy, we couldn't hire the cybersecurity candidate you sent us. He was saying too many scary things about our computers.
Ugh.
Like, yeah. Right.
That's like, so, who was it that they're threatening to go after the guy who revealed that they were revealing information about their DJI, the Phantom,
yes, the Chinese Phantom manufacturer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Go after that guy, the guy who told you what you're doing wrong. Good idea.
Yes. After he said, does penetrating your servers qualify under your bug bounty? And they said, yeah.
Oh, and then they gave him a go ahead.
Yes, wow. Exactly.
Wow.
And then they decided, oh, we're not happy with you anymore. So. Right. Yeah, I mean, it is a dicey relationship. Anyway, I love that, you know, we wanted to hire the cybersecurity guy, but he really scared us about our computer. So we said, no,
we want someone to just bring ice cream, please.
Yeah, we don't want anything scary.
No troubling news, no.
That's right. So anyway, yesterday was the 32nd birthday of Windows. The version 1.0 of Microsoft Windows went RTM, released to manufacturing, as we used to call it back then. Now it's kind of rolling disclosure. Back once upon a time when they actually said, okay, we're done, that was RTM. And that was 1985. So wow. 32 years ago and a day, 32 years yesterday, Windows turned 32. Then, okay, so that was November 20th, 85. December 9th, 87, so a little more than 2 years later, 2 years and kind of half a month, was Windows 2.0. And then, so that's December 9th, 87. Then May 22nd, 1990, that was the big one. That was Windows 3, where they finally like, okay, they're beginning to get this right. Remember, and everyone remembers Windows 3.11, that was like, everybody was happy. We had memory management. We were able to access more than 640 megs. You could do more than one thing at a time. And it was like, okay, this is kind of usable. I mean, our screens were still freezing and it was crashing constantly. You had to always be saving all your work. Otherwise, you know, it would all be lost. But those were the fun pioneering days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much remember that. We've come a long way.
We really have, yes. Yeah. It's, you know, it kind of works now, pretty much.
Amazingly.
after 32 years. Yeah. So I did want to mention just briefly, you guys covered it extensively, and I'm sure you'll be talking about it with Jeff and Stacy tomorrow on This Week in Google. This morning, FCC's chairman, Ajit Pai, who has made the reversal of the previous administration's net neutrality protections one of his top priorities, unveiled the FCC's plan to give internet providers broad powers to determine what websites and online services their customers can see and use, and at what cost. So in other words, the end of federal government enforced net neutrality. That's the announcement. The final decision, which will be put to a vote next month on Thursday, December 14th, just over 3 weeks from now, is expected to pass if the votes fall along political party lines as they're expected to, since Ajit Pai's Republican Party holds 3 of the commission's 5 seats with 2 Democrats in the other 2. So, you know, if the vote falls 3-2, that passes, and then the FCC has done what they said they were going to do in the run-up. So, you know, and again, I don't want to beat this to a pulp, but this essentially allows the ISPs to not be treated like a common carrier with a hands-off policy, but to, if they choose to throttle traffic, to enforce different sorts of plans depending upon what it is you're downloading. In other words, you arguably at the moment, we're paying our ISP for our connection to the internet, and the presumption is, and what has always been the case, you have access to the entire world equally. And that is a luxury that may be changing. So, sadly.
Yeah, terrible.
And, you know, it's a problem, too, because, I mean, if you think, okay, well, what if in another 2.5 years, or it would be 3.5 years, well, I guess about 3 years, we switch back to a Democratic executive, and if there are lots of seats moved back in that direction in the House and the Senate, and all this changes again. I mean, the problem is we're seeing a lot of this changing of policy based on who's in Washington, which is very expensive for businesses who, you know, need to have some sort of planning horizon that allow them to do what they want to do, regardless of which side they fall down on this. So I don't know. And then you guys were talking, I've not followed what happens in localities. That is, for example, California is tending to be rather activist on the Democratic side. Well, can California enforce some change?
Yeah, that's what that was among the other things they're proposing with this, is that supersedes all state and local laws, which is appalling, frankly.
Well,
these are the big states' rights peoples. Oh, but care.
I was just going to say that unfortunately, the Republicans have been all into this federation and not having all the power concentrated in Washington. And
yeah, no, that's not
and
true.
And so except where they
only
want
where,
it to be.
Yes. So. Only it comes to a few social issues.
Well, so that we don't descend into politics, let's talk about the good news is there are some takeaways for our listeners. And I love it when listeners can do something. This is Intel's response to what we discussed last week, which is this horrific JTAG. I mean, it's just hard to even say the phrase JTAG over USB. We explained last week that what JTAG is, it's this universally supported, universally recognized, essentially serial debugging interface, which for embedded systems and Intel's IME, their management engine, is an embedded system by definition. What is going to be disclosed in more detail next month by the guys at Positive Technologies, the research firm who found this, is in more detail what this is. So, and what's really interesting to me is, was it a bug that allowed JTAG over USB? I don't understand how that can be, but maybe it was somehow the USB interface is abused to get access to JTAG. But it sounds more like a feature, like, oh yeah, we intended to export the JTAG serial debugging interface over the serial USB interface to make it easier. So you didn't have to open the box in order to access pins on the chip. It's like, okay. But anyway, what has been revealed, and to their credit, Intel scrambled in order to respond, although we also got a bunch of corporate speak. You know, so Intel, in their announcement of this, or sort of acknowledging announcement, says, quote, "In response to issues identified by external researchers, Intel has performed an in-depth, comprehensive security review of our Intel Management Engine, Intel Server Platform Services, and Intel Trusted Execution Engine with the objective of enhancing firmware resilience." And of course, I'm thinking, wouldn't it have been nice if they'd done that in the beginning rather than like now? As a result, they write, Intel has identified security vulnerabilities that could potentially place impacted platforms at risk. Uh-huh. So it turns out in their disclosure, we're talking 9 years of chipsets. That is going back 9 years. this the earlier chips are affected. So this is the ME firmware versions from 11.0, 0.5, 0.6, 0.7, 0.10, 0.20, SPS firmware 4, and TXE, that's the Trusted Execution Engine, 3 are impacted. And then they said, based on the items identified through the comprehensive security review, which the disclosure, the public disclosure of these forced them to apparently do, they write, an attacker could gain unauthorized access to platform, Intel ME feature, and third-party secrets protected by the Intel Management Engine, Server Platform Service, and Trusted Execution Engine. This includes scenarios where a successful attacker could impersonate the ME, SPS, TXE, thereby impacting local security feature attestation validity, load and execute arbitrary code outside the visibility of the user and operating system. In other words, as we know, you know, down in the ring minus three zone where nothing exists except this environment, which is then able, but which despite the fact that it's so low, has access to everything going on above, cause a system crash or system instability. And then they say, for more information, please see this Intel support article. Now, there is, they have in response to this, fixed the problems. Unfortunately, you don't get Intel firmware from Intel. Your motherboard manufacturer or laptop or desktop, whatever manufacturer, they have the relationship with Intel. We, as the customers, have the relationship with them. So at this point, only Lenovo is listed on Intel's documents and has very quickly provided comprehensive coverage. And Leo, there's a link in the show notes, and to our listeners, there's a link in the show notes that is very extensive, support.lenovo.com, with a firmware update listing by model number for laptops, for desktops, for everything. And, you know, for example, my Carbon X1 Lenovo is there. But the other cool thing, and this is as I was mentioning, there's a takeaway for our listeners, is that Intel has published a detection tool. Yay. The link is in the show notes. I can say it because it's not too gnarly. So it's downloadcenter.intel.com/download/27150. So once again, https://downloadcenter.intel.com/download/27150. It is available both for Windows and Linux, and there's a command line version and a graphical user interface version. Grab the one you want, and this is very nice. This will allow you to determine whether the system you're running it on has these problems and therefore needs its firmware updated. And so understand that these are serious motherboard firmware, both remote over the network and local. So this is fixing many things, only one of which, I think it's 5705 was the number that's the CSV assigned. Only one is the USB JTAG bug. I can't wait to find out next month, like, what's the nature of this? Did they discover JTAG on USB? Did they abuse something in order to get it? Did Intel mean to publish JTAG out of the USB ports? This is really interesting to me because it's so crazy to do that. Or is it fine, do they think, as long as there are no bugs? I just don't know. So there are still a bunch of questions. But in the meantime, certainly for enterprises who have a large number of identical systems, as we were talking about last week, this is, you know, there is now a detection tool. So thank you, Intel, for that. And unfortunately, it will be then up to the producers of the retail versions of these systems, like Lenovo that's using Intel chipsets, like Dell, well, like everybody essentially, to arrange to provide the similar patches as Lenovo has that people can run on their machines in order to fix them.
It's interesting because I got an update to the firmware, the ME firmware 11.8 on November 1st, but I just got a update to that 11.8 with a more recent number, 11.8.50.3425. I'm guessing that this is the fix, but I'm going to run the install. I'm showing it right now on the screen, and then I'll run the Intel. The Intel program will tell us whether we've been patched or just whether...
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
It will tell you whether you are running a version of firmware which they know to be vulnerable.
Okay.
And so it'll say, yes, you know, you're current and you're not susceptible. And so is that on a Lenovo?
That's
on
the X1 Yoga second generation, nice. Which was marked as vulnerable. So.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Good.
That's good to know.
Let us know.
Hey, that's one of the reasons I buy ThinkPads. I know you love your X1 Carbon.
I really
love these laptops.
Yep. And I agree with you, too, that the keyboard really feels nice.
It's a good laptop.
They've not sacrificed it the way Apple, unfortunately, has in order to make it, you know, incredibly thin. It's like, look.
I like the X1 Carbon, but I wanted the 2-in-1 screen, and I wanted the OLED screen. And I really splurged on an OLED screen. But, boy, it sure looks good. It's great. I use it for photography, so it's okay.
So we have another case of an exposed Amazon Web Services bucket. Well, okay, three buckets, actually. What?
Well, I'm just, you know, it's another case.
I know.
And the last one was a government bucket, wasn't it? I know.
This one is.
Okay.
It's Chris Vickery of UpGuard. He's the guy who has recently been discovering these open and publicly accessible AWS shares. He's found three buckets belonging to the U.S. Department of Defense, the DOD.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Both CENTCOM and PACCOM, which are intelligence gathering operations, the three S3 buckets were configured to allow anyone with an Amazon Web Services account, which of course anyone can get, to access them, and were labeled CENTCOM-backup. Okay, that's, you don't have to guess much what that is. Lord. CENTCOM-archive and PA or PACCOM-archive. In response to this, CENTCOM responded in their typical bureau speak, saying, "We determined that the data was accessed via unauthorized means by employing methods to circumvent security protocols."
Yeah, the browser.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Said Major Josh Jacques, a spokesperson for U.S. Central Command. Once alerted to the unauthorized access, CENTCOM implemented additional security measures to prevent unauthorized access. Translation, we decided not to leave the password field blank. So, my Lord. Yeah. So UpGuard posted, they said, the data exposed in one of the three buckets is estimated, and get this, to contain at least 1.8 billion posts of scraped internet content over the past 8 years, including content captured from news sites, comment sections, web forums, and social media sites such as Facebook, featuring multiple languages and originating from countries around the world. Among those are many apparently benign public internet and social media posts by Americans, collected in an apparent Pentagon intelligence gathering operation, which raises questions of privacy and civil liberties.
I think they just found their Reddit porn folder. And
while a cursory, UpGuard writes, while a cursory examination of the data reveals loose correlations of some of the scraped data to regional U.S. security concerns, such as with posts concerning Iraqi and Pakistani politics, the apparently benign nature of the vast number of captured global posts, as well as the origination of many of them within the U.S., raises serious concerns about the extent and legality of known Pentagon surveillance against U.S. citizens. In addition, it remains unclear why and for what reasons the data was accumulated, presenting the overwhelming likelihood that the majority of posts captured originate from law-abiding citizens across the world. So, whoops, caught with their pants down because they decided not to put a password on their 1.8 billion archive named CENTCOM-archive, thus not even a disguised name. Wow.
Obviously, they collected it and they just left it there and they, you know, forgot about it.
Yeah, although, you know, you have to wonder, like, maybe it got collected and then they transferred it to a bucket to make it available to other people, you know, to sort of like, you know, because you would hope that they're not collecting it in an Amazon cloud bucket. It's like, okay, what? You know, that's where I keep this podcast backed up.
Yeah.
But, you know, you don't want the US DOD to be archiving its internet scraping.
But do we care that they're scraping internet posts?
Nah, I guess not really.
Posts.
It's public. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So Android was discovered to be all of this year, starting in early January, to be sending tracking information back to Google without the user's permission. This was from some research that Quartz did. Throughout all of 2017, Android devices with all location tracking permissions disabled, and even without a carrier SIM card installed. So you'd kind of think, okay, I'm off the grid. They've been sending, it turns out, the IDs of all cell towers within range back to Google for some kind of analysis, which Google acknowledged after the guys at Quartz observed the behavior and said, what's going on with this, Google? When all location tracking has been disabled. So in their reporting, Quartz wrote, the cell tower addresses have been included in information sent to the system Google uses to manage push notifications and messages on Android phones for the past 11 months, which was acknowledged by a Google spokesperson. Google said they were never used or stored, and the company is now taking steps to end the practice after being contacted by Quartz. By the end of November, this month, so like a week and a half, the company said, Google said, Android phones will no longer send cell tower location data to Google, at least as part of this particular service, which consumers cannot disable. Google explained to Quartz by email that, quote, in January of this year, we, Google, began looking into using cell ID codes as an additional signal to further improve the speed and performance of message delivery. However, they said, we never incorporated cell ID into our network sync system, so that data was immediately discarded, and we updated it to no longer request cell ID. So, you know, I guess my feeling is, okay, not a big deal. There were some panting and huffing and puffing on the internet about this. It's like, you know, I think there's a worthwhile debate about what truly is anyone's reasonable expectation of privacy when you're walking around with one of these, you know, deeply internet connected computers keeping your pocket warm. You know, my own feeling is that anyone carrying a cell phone should have a very low expectation of privacy. By its very nature, it's a heavily internet-connected computer that its own user, did not design and build. So it could be doing anything, and we keep finding that indeed it is doing anything. So, you know, if you don't wish to be tracked and monitored, leave the phone at home. It's just not realistic, I think, to imagine that it's possible to have it both ways. You've got a machine that is you want all kinds of incredible features from, and, you know, take the battery out. That would probably do it, you know, like the way they do in the movies.
I don't think Google has yet figured out how to keep it going with the battery out. Pretty sure they don't have that.
And unfortunately, we can't take the batteries out, actually.
Oh,
so.
Never mind. now the conspiracy theories are really going
and
crazy.
The question is, when you shut it completely off, is it really off?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Now the new Apple Macintosh apparently has an ARM chip that will continue to run even if the Intel chip is powered down.
I just think, you know, we old fogies actually care about such things, but
nobody else does. Just the people listening to this show.
And speaking of old fogies caring about stuff,
the name of this, that's a subtitle of this show.
That is old fogies still giving a, you know what? Yes. We've talked about this before, but there's some interesting new research out of Princeton. Websites are logging keystrokes and mouse movements in real time, whether or not their users ever click submit. This is known, has been named by Princeton, the researchers there, as session replay scripts. So researchers at Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy have a cool site. We've talked about it from time to time through the years. Freedom to Tinker is there. It's Freedom to Tinker with the words separated by hyphens. So freedom-to-tinker.com, where they blog about stuff that they found. They call this their No Boundaries Exfiltration of Personal Data by Session Replay Scripts. Last week, they posted the result of their analysis of websites that are using JavaScript to monitor their visitors' actions and activities while people are present on the site, meaning that you just go to a website and stuff starts happening before you press any buttons. And, you know, we've talked about this in various this sort of behavior in the past. How once upon a time in the quaint old days, but you know, when Windows was young, which is now 32 years ago, before contemporary websites could run code, powerful code, in the web browsers of everyone who visited, what used to be the case is a static page was delivered and it just sat there. And it was only when we went to another page on that site, clicking a link, or when we explicitly and deliberately filled out a form and then submitted it to the site, that it saw anything further from us. But, you know, today's websites are not going to be content with that. They want to know what is going on at the other end to every degree possible. So we've talked about how even the position of the user's mouse can be monitored. We talked about it in the context of that the latest version of Google's CAPTCHA, you know, the I'm not a robot, where all you have to do is just click on the box making that declaration. Yeah, I'm not a robot. And the point is that they use a number of signals, one being watching your mouse as it moves, as it kind of zeroes in on the checkbox, deciding if you're a computer calculating at an arc or if you seem human based on the fact that, you know, the way you move the mouse. The point is, so there's sort of a, you could argue, kind of a benign use case for constant mouse position monitoring. And in fact, over on the keystroke side, I'm using a web page's ability to dynamically watch your keystrokes on that on GRC's password haystacks page. When you go to the password haystacks, as you're entering, as you're playing with it, putting in passwords, with every single keystroke, I'm recomputing and showing you the size of the alphabet, how long it would take to brute force the password. That's all being done with client-side script, which is being awakened every time the user hits a key to capture now the password in that field and then recompute everything. So again, a nice, benign, friendly, you know, user-facing benefit to being able to do this. But we now also have a technology known as WebSockets, which allows code running on a web page to silently initiate a connection back to the mothership, or in this case, to the third-party provider of the JavaScript, which is running on the page, and to dynamically send to stream in real time everything that the page's user is doing without them having any awareness of it, having given permission or anything. I mean, the presumption is you go to a site, you're sort of turning yourself over to the site more and more as we move through the years with, you know, ads and videos playing. By the way, Ars Technica has started to do this a lot, and it's really annoying me.
I pay for a subscription, and I think that helps.
Okay, because I mean, I'm looking at 47 megabits into it's like, holy crap, really? You know, to show me a video that's, I don't want.
Yeah. That's really way too prevalent now.
Yeah. So, okay. So the researchers at Princeton have named this practice replay scripts. I have a typo in my show notes. Since the stream can be replayed at the hosting end to recreate the user's actions on the page. For example, did they scroll? So like the scroll position of the page is being streamed back. Where is the mouse? How far down did they maybe read? I mean, you can see how these could be useful analytics. The researchers wrote, quote, "The stated purpose of this data collection includes gathering insights into how users interact with websites and discovering broken or confusing pages. However, the extent of data collected by these services..." Now, that's the other thing. This is not just like someone like Ars, to pick on them again. I love Ars, so I don't mean to be picking on them. But for example, these are typically not their own website coders doing this. Naturally, there are third-party services where it's just, just like CoinHive, drop this little line of code on your page and we'll send you all this really cool analytic stuff. So there are third-party services which are collecting data which far exceeds probably the typical user's expectations. Text typed into forms, which is being collected before the user submits the form. So that, for example, if the user decides, whoa, wait a minute. I didn't know I was going to be asked all of this, and this is too intrusive. Doesn't matter. What they've typed in has already left the browser. It's already been streamed back as they're entering keystrokes. The mouse movements are saved, which seems a little less invasive, but without any visual indication of the user. And some companies allow publishers to explicitly link the recordings to a user's real identity. So there's within this ecosystem that all of this is being de-anonymized. They write, for this study, they analyzed 7 of the top session replay companies. So there are 7 companies that are the top ones. And I saw an 8th one mentioned in the comments to the story based on their relative popularity in their measurements. The services studied are Yandex, Full Story, Hotjar, User Replay, Smartlook, Clicktail, and Session Cam. So these are services available to websites. They wrote, we found these services in use on 482 of the Alexa top 50,000. And these are not obscure. In the show notes under web transparency, .cs.princeton.edu is their raw data. From the top of the list down, we have WordPress, Microsoft, Adobe, GoDaddy, Outbrain, Spotify, Skype, and RT. So some very well-known, non-obscure sites are employing these third-party services to provide dynamic user monitoring metrics about, you know, how their pages are used. Again, not super invasive, although I wanted to mention it because I know that our users care about these kinds of things. And this is not behavior which you would expect or is obvious when you go to a site. And of course, all brought to us now by JavaScript, which is, you just can't use the net without it any longer because so many sites are using it to enhance their functionality. So as everyone knows, I gave up on NoScript and I switched to uBlock Origin to give us some control. Oh, and speaking of which, after this reporting came out, the EasyList service was updated to include all these domains, and Gore Hill's uBlock Origin, which is already pulling from EasyList, will automatically protect users who are anyone using uBlock Origin from these third-party analytics systems. So anyone using EasyList, and I think AdBlock Plus also uses EasyList, but uBlock Origin I know does. I checked as I was pulling all this together, already blocks this. So again, another reason to consider maybe using a third-party manager to get some additional privacy enhancement. And Leo, I'm going to get some additional caffeine enhancement.
Well, good. Here, I'm going to get something that'll take your privacy away completely, but for a good cause. How about that? We're talking about the Lighthouse. Actually, this is the only camera Lisa will allow in the house because it's a security camera with a lot of smarts. But one of the things I really like is when specified owners or members, and I'll talk about the different roles you can play, come into the house. So when Lisa and I come home, the camera turns off. We don't need a security camera when we're home. Lighthouse is the smartest security camera you've ever seen. It has sensors that no one else has. For instance, this is a time of flight sensor, which is a kind of LIDAR that does a 3D image of your home. It emits invisible light. It's called time of flight because it measures how long it takes the light to bounce off of stuff. And from that makes a 3D model of everything it sees, to the point, and there's so much AI in here that it knows that there's humans and pets. So it can detect movement. It can detect whether it's a person, a pet, or an object. I have to say, I had another supposedly smart security camera before that thought some Mylar birthday balloons were an intruder and kept alerting me to them until I finally moved the balloons out of its view. So you won't get alerts for pets or sunlight or shadows or Mylar balloons. It knows who you are and who you aren't. It lets you invite people to the app so you can have family members, you can have users, you can have, you know, owners, and you can say, like the dog walker, that's not somebody I want to know about. They don't get access to the video, for instance. That's their role, but I don't get alerted to them. When I do get a security threat, and it comes in, which is nice, the Lighthouse app, it comes in on my smartphone. Here, let me launch it for you and show you. I can see if there's somebody in the house. I can trigger an alarm. I can even call 911. See, it says call 911. Oh, there, somebody walked through the house. Now, I happen to know who that is. It's my assistant, Sarah, but that's okay. So you see how it outlined her? I don't know if you can see that on the phone, but it's actually outlining the human in red. That's that LIDAR working. I could see a live image from our living room. I can say call 911. This is at 4:11 p.m. Actually, so that was yesterday. So I'm going to say that's okay. And I'm going to keep the security alerts on for future. I can get a daily recap of activity, which is so cool. Pets and humans. But my favorite part, by the way, is here's the people who are members, authorized users. I could see all the images of me and look and see if it's me or not. And then trigger the, say, that's not me. Don't think that's me. Actually, it's we've used it for months now, and so it's actually very accurate on the owners. I could see the alerts. Leo Laporte left. Leo Laporte arrived. I could see what's going on in the house. And then it's got the best feature. It's got artificial intelligence. I could say, for instance, tell me, like I could say, did you see any new people today? And the AI, this was created by a guy who competed in the DARPA challenge. So he's an expert, right, in the AI stuff. He started the company. Ping me if you see the kids with the cat. There's even a feature, if somebody waves at the camera, it'll give me a notification on my phone. Hey, Abby's trying to get a hold of you. It's awesome. 1080p live stream, two-way talk, night vision, of course, a 30-day video history, permission settings for three different kinds of people, owners, members, users. So I love it that I could turn off the camera. It's the only reason that Lisa, she won't let any other camera in the house. She doesn't want the camera on when we're in the house. She doesn't want anybody to see her in her jammies. But now I don't have to worry about that. And you're going to get early access as TWIT listeners. And just for you, just in time for the holiday season, go to light.house, okay? light.house/twit, 40% off your very own Lighthouse and the Lighthouse Intelligence Service Plan. You can't even buy it on the main website. This is only for TWIT listeners. light.house/twit. They're sold out in the pre-orders, but they have a special allotment. light.house/twit, 40% off. That's a total savings of $200. Don't wait. It's only good while supplies last. And if you do it right now, you'll have it in time for the holidays. This would be a great gift for family members, too. We use it, and I love it. I know exactly what's going on. In fact, our cat was missing, and Lisa was using this to see, and the cat was coming home in the middle of the night. So we reassured her. She said, oh, there, I see Hamilton. That is pretty cool. And she didn't have to search through a lot of video. She just says, show me when pets come through the house after midnight. And it showed her all of the pictures of all the cats, including the missing cat who wasn't really missing, but just was sneaking home at night to eat. light.house/twit. This is fantastic. Artificial intelligence, the only camera I know of with a time of flight sensor that gives it a 3D view of what's going on. You'll see the people and the pets outlined so you know exactly what's going on. This is just a great product, and I love it. light.house/twit, 40% off, but only, don't tell anybody, just for you. Because if they sell out, that's it. We're going to have to wait till the next, and they're getting a batch going pretty quick too. light.house/twit. I think this is a security camera even Steve Gibson might consider. That's cool. That's a good feature, though, that it turns off when you are home, because you don't need to watch what's going on inside the house, especially if there's lingerie involved. Lisa's smart. She says, I don't want any video go up on the internet. I know it's secure. I still don't want it up on the internet. I understand. I listen to this show.
So
she doesn't want her video in anybody's bucket. Let's put it that way, right?
That's a good don't want it in the bucket.
No.
So we've many times discussed the fallout, the really amazing fallout from the Infineon crypto library, which was found, which is used in embedded devices and found to be producing factorable private keys, which should be an oxymoron. That's, I mean, they're the whole point is that you cannot factor a private key, which is where is the way this cool technology hides the public key within the private key by multiplying these two primes, and you don't know how to pull them apart again. So Estonia, which was very forward-looking, we talked about a couple of weeks ago, had, quote, only issued 760,000 Infineon-based identity cards. Turns out to be one of the smaller players. Get this. Spain has issued 60 million of these cards. 60 million now completely useless and vulnerable identity smart cards. And remember that here's the problem is that they've issued them and they weren't very popular. I think I saw 0.02% of them were getting any use. So, but the problem with something like this is that once they cannot be trusted, no one can use them. You know, even though they're in very low common usage, now that any of them can be attacked, because that's what this means, the private key generated by the cards can be factored. And now and the price to do that, as I've also since discussed, keeps coming down. Now it's about $2,000 and a few hours in order to perform this factorization. That means that if any card can be attacked, then none of the security assertions made by any card can be trusted. Therefore, all 60 million are useless for their intended purpose, which in any given instance is that this card is producing an assertion that cannot be spoofed, cannot be later, either created or broken. And we now know that's no longer the case. So, yes, 60 million for Spain. And, boy, I don't know what kind of pain Infineon is in, what the contracts look like and so forth. But this has been a big disaster. And if nothing else, we need, you know, better oversight. The problem with that we have is that, you know, for example, Spain purchased 60 million cards without requiring a third-party security review of the technology. Infineon would have balked, but so Spain could say, you want the contract or not? You're asking us to pay you a chunk of money. We're happy to do that. We want your product, but we're not taking your word for it. We need you to put some academic researcher under NDA and examine your technology and verify independently that we should trust you. That's the kind of thing that isn't happening yet, because companies are still allowed to say, trust us, we're Infineon. And now, you know, now this is what happened. So about 10 weeks ago, 10 episodes ago, in early September, we covered the Blueborn attacks. Our listeners with a good memory will remember that there were a series of 8 newly revealed zero-day vulnerabilities which affected virtually all Bluetooth-equipped devices, regardless of OS, both Windows and Linux and IoT devices, embedded OSs, Android was affected. It was big. Smartphones, laptops, TVs, IoT devices, you name it. And these attacks which were enabled by these eight new zero-day vulnerabilities, were extra potent, more so than usual, because no user interaction was required, no Bluetooth association was required. All that was required is that a malicious device leveraging the Blueborn attacks would get within radio range, which is typically 10 meters, about 30 feet, of a device with a Bluetooth radio on, and that would allow, without any involvement from the devices, from the target device's user, remote compromise. So there was responsible disclosure. Lots of people, you know, scrambled around and updated their Bluetooth stacks in order to fix these eight newly discovered problems. Well, it turns out that another very popular pair of devices were also vulnerable, and that's Amazon's Echo and Google's Home. Apparently numbering about 20 million, 15 for Amazon, 5 million for Google. The IoT security firm Armis, who was the original discoverer of the Blueborn attacks, has disclosed that an additional estimated 20 million Amazon Echo and Google Home devices are also vulnerable to the attacks. They responsibly disclosed their discovery that the Echo and the Home were also vulnerable. Amazon and Google have both implemented and issued patches, so that this news is only coming out after the fact. But you do want to make sure that the good news is these devices are updating themselves. So it's unlike having an old Android phone where you're out in the dark at this point. There were two different CVE vulnerabilities affecting the Amazon and one affecting the Google device. And there was also a denial of service attack. Basically, you could just, you know, crash your Google Home. Not that that would do the attacker much good. But in these devices, the Bluetooth radios cannot be disabled. That was our advice 10 weeks ago. Until you were sure that you had an update, just turn off Bluetooth if you were likely to be targeted. I mean, it wasn't because it required physical proximity. Some bad guy had to be within 30 feet of you, which seemed unlikely, or much less than an internet-based attack that could be executed from anywhere else on the globe. They did responsibly notify, and the patches are out. So, the problem has been dodged. But this does further reinforce one of the lessons we keep coming back to here, which is the absolute necessity of all interconnected devices, whether they be $1,000 smartphones or $7 light bulbs, to be remotely updatable. We talked a couple weeks ago that there is a forthcoming, hopefully to be adopted, RFC describing a means for doing this, basically moving old school big iron internet technology, the idea of having multiple firmware images from which you can boot either, to allow a device to be updated and then rebooted from the other image in order to bootstrap itself into improved code. But boy, it's, if anything is smart enough to have firmware, it needs to be smart enough to have that firmware updated. I think that's probably the perfect way of saying it. If anything is smart enough to contain firmware, that firmware needs to be smart enough to update itself, to arrange, to keep itself current. Because if it's smart and has firmware, what we're seeing is it can be abused. And so, from the, as I said at the top of the show, well, that didn't take long, department. Boy, we discussed with some skepticism on my part, I will say, a week or two ago, the release of Amazon's great new feature, Amazon Key, where, as our listeners will remember, a special Amazon camera would be positioned to look at the, you know, foyer, the entryway of a person's home, where there would be the front, you know, the back, it would be seeing the inside of the front door and the inside area. You would also have a internet-enabled smart lock on the door, and that Amazon is able to control. So the idea would be this solves the problem, which, Leo, you were explaining. I don't have the problem, but I guess it is a big problem for in some areas of Amazon wanting to deliver packages and it just being unsafe from a security standpoint. Packages are disappearing, apparently, from people's front porch.
It's a
big
problem around here, yeah.
Okay. So,
and by the way, another problem, which frankly doesn't encourage me. Remember we said it was only in areas where Amazon Logistics did the delivery.
Ah, right.
Well, I've learned that Amazon Logistics often comes in unmarked cars by a person. They basically do it like Uber. So now you're letting somebody just who drives up your driveway in an unmarked car walk in your house.
Yep. Yep. And I got such a delivery last night.
Yeah.
This is a person who didn't know where I was. And I got a phone call from area code 209. I thought, what the heck? You know, and I just ignored it the first time. Then I called again. And I thought, okay, well, that's unusual. So I picked it up and it was a person saying, where's your house? I said, who are you?
Why do you want to know, buddy?
Yeah. Anyway, so I said, okay, I'll come out. And so I came out. It was just a big white van.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And a person who, like, maybe, you know, like, was doing this to earn some extra
cash.
They
do it like Uber. They post them, and you take up delivery jobs just like Uber.
Wow.
And so that worries me quite a bit. And those are billed as Amazon Logistics. I don't know if that means that's who's going to have access to your house or not.
Well, so get this. So just to finish the scenario, you got the camera looking at the inside of your front door. With this system, when you permit this to happen, the delivery person is able to push a button on their little handy keypad thing or maybe on their own smartphone, probably just uses their own smartphone. Your front door, the camera starts streaming. Your front door is then unlocked, allowing them under video monitoring to open the door, slide the packages in, wave hi to the camera, and then close the door. And then they press a button saying, okay, delivery completed, and the door relocks. And the idea being then that the video that was captured of this process is then sent to the owner of the home, I think a few seconds afterwards, along with a message saying your packages are safely inside your locked front door. So that didn't take long, is Rhino Labs discovered that a courier equipped with a simple program could use their laptop, and it'll be turned into an app before you know it, to fake a command from the house's Wi-Fi router to cause the Amazon Cloud Cam to be disconnected from the Wi-Fi network, which causes the camera to stop functioning and freezes the image at the last frame. So you couldn't make this up. This is like a movie. It's literally the camera stops refreshing the image. So it shows no motion, no door opening, no one sneaking in the house. So the point is that at this point, the courier could re-enter the house. And I guess they've already done this once. I don't know why it says re-enter, but the courier re-enters, does whatever they wish with no monitoring, with no surveillance, then exits and reactivates the camera and locks the door as usual. This re-entry, they write, would be undetectable by the resident and would appear like as a normal delivery in Amazon's data. So apparently this what this bug that they found, this glitch, essentially allows the first delivery to occur and apparently all goes well, but then to immediately reopen the door with the frozen camera and sneak around. And so while, yes, there would be some connection between some mischief and the delivery, if they did something like, you know, ran upstairs and stole some jewelry out of a jewelry case or something and then got back out of the house quickly,
you'd never know.
If you exactly, you would never know. If you didn't late in, if it was a few days later that you discovered that, or a month or a week or something, it's like, wait a minute, where's those earrings?
Yeah.
You, there, you have no way of associating those events. So Amazon said, in, you know, their response to this was, we currently notify customers if the camera is offline for an extended period. They said later this week, meaning this week, we will deploy an update to more quickly provide notifications if the camera goes offline during delivery. So that's good. However, the guys at Rhino Labs explaining, who know this in somewhat more detail, said while this could help Amazon Key, which is the name of the service, customers know when something is amiss, it doesn't prevent the event from happening. Ben Caudill, who's Rhino Labs founder, told Wired magazine for their reporting of this that the only way to fully close the loophole would be to cache video locally even when the camera is disconnected from the network. However, the cloud cam doesn't currently cache video locally, and doing so would require significantly more local storage than for the pure streaming, which is all it does. So to robustly fix this, you would need a hardware upgrade, you know, like maybe if it hasn't been 30 days, considering returning the cloud cam. Do you remember how expensive they are? Are they?
It was several hundred dollars for the setup because you need the cloud cam and the special Schlage lock.
Right.
Setup, and I think it was $399 or $299. It was not cheap. That was enough deterrent.
Yeah, just the cost.
Just the cost. Get a and Ring video doorbell. Leo, they'll know.
This is you, Leo, we're talking about.
I'm not letting these guys in.
No.
Plain, unmarked car. Come on.
Oh, yeah. What could possibly go wrong? So I don't have any personal knowledge of this yet because Firefox 57 doesn't look like it runs on XP. And I'm still sitting in front of XP, although I got Windows 7 and I've got 10. I mean, I have other Windows machines all over the place. I only have one XP machine, but it's going to be it's so much downtime for me to switch that I just haven't wanted to yet. I haven't needed to. But the news is Firefox 57, which is the so-called quantum release, is apparently been clocking in at 2 times the speed that it used to be.
Yep. I'm using it now. I love it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
The Hacker News guy said it is time to give Firefox another chance.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I did.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm a big Chrome user, and I know you love Firefox, but this new Quantum is great. It's beautiful.
Yeah, they said so the Hacker News wrote, the Mozilla Foundation today announced the release of its much-awaited Firefox 57, a.k.a. Quantum, web browser for Windows, Mac, and Linux, which claims to defeat Google's Chrome. They wrote, it is fast, really fast. Firefox 57 is based on an entirely revamped design and overhauled core that includes a brand new next-generation CSS engine written in Mozilla's Rust programming language called Stylo. That is, the CSS engine is called Stylo. Firefox 57 Quantum is the first web browser to utilize the full power of multi-core processors and offers 2x times faster browsing experience while consuming 30% less memory than Chrome. Besides fast performance, Firefox Quantum, which Mozilla calls, quote, by far the biggest update since Firefox 1.0 in 2004, so 13 years ago, also brings massive performance improvements with tab prioritization and significant visual changes. God, now I'm super excited to try this.
Leo. It looks like Edge, which is weird, but it's a very clean UI.
Nice, nice. I will be using it tonight because I have a Win 7 on my Carbon X1. Mm-hmm. With a completely redesigned, they write, UI called Photon. This new version also adds in support for AMD's VP9 hardware video decoding during, and as we know, VP9 is kind of moving toward becoming the standard codec for the net, during playback to reduce power consumption and thus helping to prevent systems from draining their batteries. Firefox 57 also includes built-in screenshot functionality, improved tracker blocking, and support for web VR to enable websites to take full advantage of VR headsets. Firefox has plans to speed things even further by leveraging modern GPUs in the near future. Firefox Quantum for the desktop version is available for download now on Firefox's official website, and all existing Firefox users should be able to upgrade to the new version automatically. The Android version is rolling out on Google Play shortly in coming days, and its iOS version should eventually arrive on Apple's official App Store. So, yow and yay.
Yeah, I've been using it for a while on Windows, and nice. I really like it. Yeah,
nice. So, a tiny bit of miscellany. My Twitter account is creeping up towards 60,000 followers. I was put in mind of it because I think it was Simon Zarafa who caused me to take a look at Shields Up. We are just shy of the 100 million mark.
Wow.
Of Shields Up users. We're getting, I checked, about 4,500 new Shields Up uses per day. So we're about 45,000 shy of 100 million. So in about 10 days from now, probably just shy of next week's podcast, we will be crossing the 100 million served mark. And these are not multiply counted. If a user goes there and does several Shields Up uses during one session, I only count them as one use. I maintain the most recent 4096 IPs from which Shields Up is being used in a most recently used an MRU list, putting anyone who's not found at the bottom and knocking the oldest off the top. So I did that from day one. So that's a really solid, separate 100 million use mark. So very cool. Then, of course, Shields Up is what got me into the security business. It was when I discovered that people's Windows hard drives were like mapped as C:, on the public internet. I thought, okay, somebody's got to bring this to the world's attention. So I did. And I love this tweet. This was a retweet from Simon Zarafa, who was retweeting Stephen Cole, who had just phrased things in a fun way. He said, the U.S. dollar plummets to a new low of 0.00013 bitcoins. And in fact, I checked yesterday when I first posted this into my own notes for the show, and then again this morning, $8,200 is where
we gotta unlock our wallets.
I gotta go find mine.
You're a lot richer than I am. You have 50.
Wow, I do. Yikes,
wealthy man,
indeed. And so, two notes about SpinRite from a Benjamin Rose. He tweeted, "Steve, could hard drive ECC, that's the error correction, be disabled on a hard disk? If so, could that be in the next SpinRite release?" He says, "I'd rather let Dynastat do the work instead of the controller's ECC. SpinRite does a better job. And so to Benjamin, he should know that's always been there. SpinRite always disables error correction as one of the things that it does. It does the recovery in multiple phases, but it, for example, you would never want to be doing surface analysis and checking the surface for defects if error correction was in place, because it would hide the defect. And so SpinRite has always been capable of dynamically bypassing error correction when it wants to get to the truth about the disc. And then, however, if it is during the data recovery phase, if it is unable to recover the data to get a perfect read, then it will re-enable error correction in order to deliberately bring the error correction back online in order to use its leverage, the error correction leverage, to get just one final last fully corrected read before it then frees the drive up to map that out as a bad and uncorrectable sector. Then it maps a new one in and replaces the recovered data back in place. So all this happens behind the scenes with the user just saying, wow, look at that thing spin. So this is what's going on with SpinRite. So a lot of technology that isn't normally seen. And then a second tweet, Naruto Uzumaki, I hope I said that right. He said, while more is fun, on a clearly failing 1 gig Sony MicroVault flash drive, a level 4 scan using SpinRite is able to temporarily fix it. And, okay, so I just did want to mention that this tweet put me in mind of just saying to people that, you know, there's a limit to how much SpinRite can pull, how far back from the grave SpinRite can pull data. And so, you know, if someone just wants to play with SpinRite by like watching it fix a drive that is really trying to die, it can keep doing so, but there's a limit. So I do want to encourage people not to confuse SpinRite's ability to, in some cases, perform miracles of data recovery with that also being a signal that it's time to swap the drive out. You know, like use SpinRite to make the drive readable, yeah. Make an image, make
don't
a backup.
Keep using it.
But yeah, just, you know, don't, after your 50th recovery, it's like, oh yeah, it won't keep doing it forever. Sooner or later, the drive is going to win this battle. So, you know, use SpinRite to pull it from the gray zone. But once it gets too far into the black, you're really in trouble.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Don't push it too far.
Yeah. Tempting.
Okay. So we have time today, finally, for some closing the loop feedback from our listeners. And after our next and final sponsor, we're going to do that and then talk about Quad 9.
Ooh, I can't wait. People have been asking you to do this for a while, so I'm looking forward to hearing about it. I saw that F-Secure is now doing a hardware security device router as well. So this must be a hot new category. We'll talk about that in a second, but first a word from our sponsor, IT Pro TV. I talk to people almost every week. Somebody's coming into the studio to visit. Often they come to see this show, and the minute they sit down, they say, "Oh, and by the way, I'm in the IT business now, thanks to Steve and IT Pro TV." And that is very, very common. IT Pro TV is kind of what, if you like this show, you'll love IT Pro TV, a 24/7 network with shows, deep dives into the content that you need to know if you're in IT or you want to get into IT. According to the Bureau of Labor, and you want to get into IT, listen to this. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics last year, there were more than 1 million job openings in cybersecurity alone, many of them still unfilled. They need you. They want you. Now's the time to go to IT Pro TV and either get those certs like the CEH or ISSC squared cert that will get you that job, or if you're already in IT, to get you those additional skills that'll make you even more valuable to your current employer and perhaps to some future employer who might be saying, we need somebody now. And by the way, you don't have to go to work for somebody who says, we don't want to hire him. He's telling us bad news. You want to go to the people who want to hear the bad news. IT Pro TV offers 2,000 hours of on-demand training because they have multiple studios now. They first started, Tim and Don were IT trainers, you know, traditional IT trainers, you know, did the classroom thing and all that. And they saw TWIT and they thought, what if we did a TWIT, a network of streaming internet shows, but that were just about IT content, just full IT content. They have now so far surpassed us. First of all, 2,000 hours of on-demand training online now, and they're making 125 hours more every week because they've got, that sounds like, and I would guess, three or four studios. They have five total in constant use. You can stream them live or on demand on a Chromecast. They have a Roku channel, a Fire TV channel. They've got a great Apple TV app. So you can put it on your big screen TV. Of course, you can stream it from the website, itpro.tv/securitynow. They also have iOS and Android apps. So really, I mean, imagine the scenario. You get up in the morning, you fire up your Roku, you got IT Pro TV on while you're eating breakfast, you get in the car, you put it on your phone, you drive to work, you get to work, you put it on your computer. You can have in the background going as much attention span as you've got, but that's beautiful. It's all flowing into your mind. And if you want to learn security, they've got courses, the CEH cert, of course, but also how to use Kali Linux, Linux security techniques, ITIL, the ISC squared security cert, and of course, more all the time. They are always covering the latest security too, much like we do here. So it's not just teaching to the test, but keeping you up on things like Kraken, Roka, and cybersecurity. And that's on the live stream. They have a chat room going just as we do. They have Q&A groups, so you can go in there, like study groups. So even though you may be studying at home on your own, you're in a group setting as well, so you can get the help and support of your you know, compatriots. Get the certs you need, the CRISC, the CISSP, the CISM, the CISA, the CEH. Advance your IT career. Get a job in IT. And by the way, now I'm talking to individuals here, but they have a team solution that's great too. They've got a group pricing. They've got a supervisor portal. You can keep an eye on your team's training schedule, assign training, create custom groups. You could see analytics both for, you know, an individual and for the group as a whole. You can even see, like, when do they log in, how much time do they watch, what do they download, and, of course completion tracking, too, so you know when they've finished and they're ready to go. I love itpro.tv. You will, too. itpro.tv/securitynow. They're even great to just check out, like, oh, I want to learn Wireshark. No problem. I want to learn Kali Linux. No problem. They've got so much great training there. You're going to get a free 7-day trial when you go to itpro.tv/securitynow. That's if you sign. If you want an individual membership, you have to use the offer code SN30. But that's not all. You can also get a free demo of the supervisor portal if you're running a team and see what you can do there. Oh, and by the way, if you sign up for the 7-day free trial with SN30, you also get 30% off your subscription forever, as long as you stay active. That makes it a really reasonable, easy way to get the skills you need. itpro.tv/securitynow. Offer code again, SN30. 7-day trial, 30% off. I can't sing their praises more highly. And I know because I talk to people all the time who tell me that's how they keep current. That's how they got the skills they need to get a better job or to keep their current one. And, of course, a lot of them are listening to this show as well. This is an education in itself. So what is it? Quad 9? What is that?
Okay, so Quad 9 is a new DNS service.
Like Open DNS, kind of?
Exactly. Very, very interesting. It was founded by a consortium of three groups, IBM Security, a group called the Packet Clearinghouse, PCH. They're providing the global internet infrastructure. And then there's a group known as the Global Cyber Alliance, which is the third piece of this. So this is, it's called Quad 9 because the DNS is 9.9.9.9.
Okay.
And the 9 dot network is IBM's class A, you know, their, what is it, 24 million IPs that IBM has. So they decided they wanted to support this. They have a security group, the IBM X-Force. So curious about this, I fired up the GRC's DNS benchmark, and I've got a screenshot of it here in the show notes. I added 9.9.9.9 to the list of DNS servers that were already built in. The DNS benchmark uses the ones that my system has, which is naturally it's Cox, since I'm a Cox cable subscriber, and then a bunch of others that it knows about. And then I added 9.9.9.9 myself. It's possible people don't know this, but if you right click on the little icon, the little starburst icon in the upper left, there's a big drop down menu list, and you can do things like add servers. You can create an INI file to make those choices sticky and so forth. Anyway, ran the benchmark, and it is comparing 9.9.9.9 to all the, there are like 50 other DNS servers. Not surprisingly, the ones for Cox were the fastest because they're, I mean, absolutely the closest to me. They're at the other end of my cable. But the 9.9.9.9 was not noticeably slower. That is, it was at the very top of the list, despite just being a universally usable DNS server. Now, they're doing this by using Anycast routing, which automatically finds and uses the nearest DNS server to the user. So at the time of this launch, which is now, there are 70 points of presence, that is 70 physical servers located in 40 countries, but that number is growing to 160 through 2018. So this service is launching with 70 and will be more than doubling to 160 servers. So people will be getting them even closer to them. So what is it? So the focus is a privacy and security enhancing DNS service, which is completely free to use. It's recursive Anycast DNS that provides end users with robust security protections, high performance, and privacy. From their own description, under security, they said Quad 9 blocks against known malicious domains, preventing, they wrote, your computers and IoT devices from connecting to malware or phishing sites. Whenever a Quad 9 user clicks on a website link or types in an address into a web browser, they write, Quad 9 will check the site against the IBM X-Force threat intelligence database of over 40 billion analyzed web pages and images. Quad 9 also taps feeds from 18 additional threat intelligence partners to block a large portion of the threats that present risk to end users and businesses alike. They said for underperformance, and I verified this myself just from here, Quad 9 systems are distributed worldwide in more than 70 locations at launch, with more than 160 locations in total on schedule for 2018. These servers are located primarily at internet exchange points, meaning that the distance and time required to get answers is lower than almost any other solution. For example, OpenDNS is in the benchmark and didn't show up. I mean, they're way slower than right now than Quad 9 is. These systems, they write, are distributed worldwide, not just in high population areas, meaning users in less well-served areas can see significant improvements in speed on DNS lookups. The systems are anycast, meaning that queries will automatically be routed to the closest operational system. Under privacy, no personally identifiable information is collected by the system. IP addresses of end users are not stored on disk or distributed outside of the equipment answering the query in the local data center. Quad9 is a nonprofit organization dedicated only to the operation of DNS services. There are no other secondary revenue streams for personally identifiable data, and the core charter of the organization is to provide secure, fast, private DNS. And of course, it's easy to use, and I'll be switching to it like when we hang up the podcast. I'm switching completely to it. Administrators can easily configure endpoint devices to point to the Quad9 DNS server at address 9.9.9.9. Oh, and I did some more digging about the technology because they mention also having a whitelist. They have a blacklist. They also maintain a whitelist of the top 1 million sites on the internet to prevent inadvertent spoofing or blacklisting. So the known safe list of like major sites, you know, like, you know, all of our good ones that are known, overrides the known bad list. There's also one additional trick. They maintain so this 9.9.9.9 or 9.9.9.9 includes the block list. They also support DNSSEC, so their servers will use DNSSEC on origin DNS, which offers signed records to prevent any spoofing between the authoritative server and the Quad9 recursive DNS, and additional security features. They don't yet support DNS curve. I think I saw something about DNS over TLS, but I haven't had a chance to track it down. And I also saw a posting where someone from Quad9 was saying they were in the process of supporting, I think it was DNS Crypt is on the way. So they will be shortly offering a means for us to encrypt our connections to them so that even our own ISP is not able to snoop on what we're doing. But for me, especially for IoT devices, you know, if the idea would be we would configure our household router to not to pick up DNS from DHCP from our ISP, but to override it to 9.9.9.9, in which case all of the systems in our home, all of our PCs, our smartphones, and IoT devices would be using Quad9 to resolve the IP address for the domain. And if there's anything fishy, okay, P-H-I-S-H-Y, or flaky, we'll just get back and not found. There's no redirect page. They send back the NX domain error code, which is this domain does not exist. So, and the other advantage is, not only it's not just for the site you're visiting, as we know, but if your web browser if the site you're visiting is trusted but has been compromised and is causing your browser to attempt to pull content from a sketchy site, you just won't be able to get the IP through Quad9. So, what I was also going to mention is that 9.9.9.10. is a variant, just sort of for testing or for people who want to experiment, no block list, no DNSSEC, and some other security features are disabled. I'm not clear on why they're doing it, maybe just in case somebody wants the speed but not the security, because, I mean, again, these guys are fast. You can also do a trace route from your location if you're curious. I did, because I was. It hopped out of Cox, and then a couple other hops, and then got to Quad 9 server. So like about 8 hops, and I had a 10 millisecond round trip, which is very respectable. And again, using my own benchmark, none of the well-known alternative DNS services came close. I should have looked to see where OpenDNS was. It's easy enough to run a benchmark. Just add 9.9.9.9 to GRC's DNS bench and run it and see where it rates. So I'm very impressed. Oh, and in their FAQ, they asked themselves the question, does Quad9 share the DNS data that is generated with marketers? They said Quad9 does not and never will share any of its data with marketers, nor will it use this data for demographic analysis. Our purpose is fighting cybercrime on the internet and to enable individuals and entities to be more secure. We do this by increasing visibility into the threat landscape by providing generic telemetry to our security industry partners who contribute data for threat blocking. In other words, and I know this from having read more deeply elsewhere, in return for these other 18 additional threat intelligence partners providing that data, they receive information when anonymized information if a Quad9 user trips on one of the sources of information that the intelligence partner provides. So the threat intelligence partners get back essentially a ping when someone did attempt to access one of the records that they provided. So it's useful, but doesn't, you know, it's completely anonymized at the local server where the query is answered, with completely benign data going back to the partners. So I just don't see a downside here. These guys seem to have the right motivation. They're providing a useful service. They are basically preventing our computers from getting malware, because no known malware will be able to have a sketchy domain resolved. It'll quickly be, essentially, unless we were the absolute very first to encounter it and get infected before anybody else, before it came to the attention of any of these 19 organizations, they would immediately blacklist it. We're safe. So, which is nothing, it's not anything that any of the existing, generic ISP DNS is doing for us. And there's, like, for me at least, zero performance penalty. So I'll give it a shot. Nice. And I'll let anybody know if I change my mind. Yeah. Yes, 9.9.9.9.
Very, very nice. And I like the group of people behind it. If IBM says that, I'm going to trust them.
Yep.
You know.
Yep. And
the
they
others
are
going to keep them honest, right? That's the other good thing. It's not any one person. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And and I've got links in the show notes for anybody who wants to dig deeper, or just put in QUAD and then numeral 9, because this has been making a splash and I wanted to give it some good coverage and, the advantage of taking a deeper look and also verifying that it is absolutely as fast as your own ISP's local DNS. I'll look forward over the next week. I'm sure I'll hear some tweets from people who have run GRC's DNS benchmark against it compared to their own DNS servers. And so I'll know more next week, but it sure looks good.
Breaking story that we will undoubtedly be covering next week on a breach at Uber, fairly significant breach at Uber, that Uber paid hackers $100,000 to cover up, apparently. So
that's... Boy, these guys just do not know how to behave, do they? My Lord.
That's a good way to put it. It's just coming in, so I hope I'm not misstating that, but that's what the headline reads. And it is a fairly large amount of data. Uber has fired their chief security officer as a result. It says in October, they just announced this today, that October 2016, hackers accessed 7 million driver licenses and names, emails, phone numbers of 50 million riders. And then paid hackers $100,000. I'm sorry, did I say 50? 57 million.
Wait. Do they have the licenses of the riders?
Probably not of riders. I would guess that's from drivers.
Okay,
but they do have some information from riders.
Sure.
And they paid hackers, even worse, $100,000 to keep it hushed up. Chief Security Officer Joe Sullivan and another executive have been fired summarily as a result. Personal information of 7 million drivers, that would include driver's license numbers.
Yes.
About 600,000 U.S. driver's license numbers. And of 50 million Uber riders. But good news, no social security numbers, credit card information, trip location details, or other data were taken. But names, email addresses, and phone numbers. So if you've used Uber, somebody's got your phone number. Big deal.
But these clowns are Uber and not in the good way.
Yeah. Yeah, goobers.
Wow.
We're going to call it Goober from now on.
Goober, yes.
At the time, they were negotiating with U.S. regulators investigating other privacy violations, which is probably the reason they tried to cover it up at the time. They now say they had a legal obligation to report to regulators and drivers. Instead, they paid hackers to delete data and keep the breach quiet. Wow. Uber said it believes the information has not been used, but will not disclose the identities of the attackers. I'm not sure if they know it. None of this should have happened, said new CEO Dara Khosrowshahi, and I will not make excuses for it. We are changing the way we do business. This is before, of course, he became the new CEO. It's back under the Travis Kalanick. After the disclosure today, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman launched an investigation. I'm sure there'll be much more to talk about next week.
Wow. Good early info, my friend.
Yeah, I thought you'd want to hear that. Of course, Steve, one of the things we love about Steve, he likes to do his homework. He doesn't talk off the cuff about anything. And so anything that breaks during the show or right before the show, you'll have to just listen to his thoughts next week. And, of course, the good news is there'll be a lot more information next week about this, I'm sure. Just another breach. Just another day, another breach.
Ho-hum.
Ho-hum. You'll find this show and all of Steve's good works at his website, grc.com. That's where you'll find, of course, SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. But also stuff like Squirrel, his current project, SpinRite, Shoot the Messenger, Decombobulator, Shields Up, now, 100 million strong users.
Yay.
That's amazing. I've used it many times, of course. Really good way to test your router. When you first install it, make sure everything's copacetic. And the podcast, audio versions of the podcast, as well as transcripts, which are very valuable for searching, as well as for a lot of people like to read while they listen at grc.com. We also have audio and video of the show at our website, twit.tv/SN. And you'll find it everywhere you subscribe. You know, just look for it. I mean, this is a show you want to not only listen to every show, but keep previous shows. Lots of people re-listen. Sometimes people listen at high speed the first time and then slow it down if they need to. It's good to have a copy. Subscribe in Pocket Casts or Stitcher or iTunes or your podcast app on your phone, whatever you prefer. We will be back here, as we are most Tuesdays, at about 1:30 Pacific, right after Mac Break Weekly, whenever that ends. It was 2 o'clock today. That's 4:30 Eastern Time, 21:30 UTC. If you want to watch live, if you do watch live, join us in the chat room. They're great people in there. And it's a lot of fun. The behind-the-scenes conversation. And these, you know, people who watch the show are smart. So there's always great people in there and lots of good question and answers going on during the background. And jokes, too. I usually steal all my material from the chat room. irc.twit.tv. Don't forget twit.tv/store. The holidays are coming. And now would be a good time for you to pick up that Steve Gibson mustache cup. Twit.tv/store. This is a new vendor. We were using for a long time a vendor that had, you know, some weird countdown thing, like we got to wait till we get 1,000 ordered and all that stuff. Now you just go and buy directly. $19 for a Security Now mug. Love that mug. And the mug. It's the smug mug of Steve Gibson on the coffee mug that says Security Now. But we've got T-shirts. We also have a Security Now T-shirt, the baseball tee. Show with pride your affiliation. Plus, of course, lots of other great Twit and other shows. Oh, there's a hoodie. You know, when you're going to DEF CON next month, maybe you ought to wear the Security Now hoodie. Mr. Robot would appreciate that. Twit.tv/store. Steve, always a thrill, always a pleasure. A little bit of a short show today. I hope we haven't disappointed our vast listening audience.
Lots of good news. I think everyone's going to be putting 9999
I like
into
that.
Their routers.
Yep. Somebody said, well, they should also get the IPv6 version. Then it'd be, what, 99s?
They do support IPv6 already, so they're ready to go. Okay, buddy.
Thanks, Steve. We'll see you next time on Security Now.
Bye. Security.